Hey everyone, welcome again. This is a special time, a special class, and a big, I owe a big gratitude. The next class is given by my son-in-law. I owe him a gratitude because he made me into a grandfather just this week. So that was great. And he had a little boy. Being that I'm the grandfather, even though they're at our house, I don't wake up at night for the baby. And he does. So I'm just giving that. That's why I a very big extra thanks in the midst of all of this. The baby's just 5 days old today, I think. And the fact that he came over here now, and he's a very good husband, so he's here now to give this class, is very special. So I wish him a big mazel tov, and a big mazel tov from everybody. And here we have. I became a grandfather, and he became a dad for the first time. Okay.
Baby doesn't wake me up. I just don't go to sleep. Baruch Hashem, it's very, very special. Yeah, thank you. This may be a little easier. It's actually, everything is bashkoch haprotis. Everything falls out on its proper time and its right place. And for me, on a very personal level, having a child right at this time period, besides, there's a lot of significance on many levels. First of all, it was my birthday this past Shabbos, so having my birthday present, my little boy, was very, very special in itself. And it's obviously the time of the year which, on a very real level, correlates with us being born. The idea of Elul and the 10 days of Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur correlate to 40 days, right? The 30 days of the month of Elul, and then the 10 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur correlate to the 40 days of when the child is formed. The Gemara says that there's 40 days of Yetziras Havlad, which has many different ramifications, practically, halachically, regarding the child. There's a concept in the Gemara. The Gemara says that one could pray during the first 40 days from conception for the child to either be a male or a female, because it hasn't been determined yet. Likewise, in other ramifications, halachically, this plays a major role. But this idea of the 40 days represents also the idea of a mikveh, which is the amount of water necessary in a mikveh is 40 saw. The idea of the 40 days that we have of Noach in the Mabel, right? The great flood was 40 days. So the number of 40 relates very strongly to this idea of rebirth, change, if you want to say revision of oneself, reinitiating of one's true self. So it's, like I said, it has a very strong, it's very apropos that at this time to experience the real thing, I guess, on a very practical, real level is a very special thing. And it gives a lot of, the experience itself teaches tremendous depth in what does it mean, this idea of a rebirth or a birth, a coming into this world and starting anew, a whole new experience. So let me try to give, if I could, in the next little bit of time, a little bit of a perspective on what is this that we're talking about, this 40-day period, Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. This whole experience is something which every year we feel something. There's something that triggers us, something that makes us feel, whether it's very conscious feeling of connection, wanting to connect, the sense of, you know, a part of us that is missing perhaps. Everybody experiences something during these 40 days, which, whether it starts from El right in the beginning, or when it gets closer to Rosh Hashanah, or on Rosh Hashanah, you're hearing the shofar being blown, or Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, there's something that triggers us. A feeling, a sense, an intuition, whatever words we will use, there's something there. And we understand that there's a process, there's a preparation necessary for us to live this experience. We're going to have it in order to properly have it, in order for the experience to actually affect us, to penetrate us, to make it, you know, conscious by us. There's a necessity for a preparation. There's a necessity for something to for us to work on in order to reach this experience. The experience, the way it's described in the books of Kabbalah, in the books of Chassidus, this experience is the true, pure essence of oneself. That's what we're experiencing, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. What does it mean to experience your true essence? I can't tell you, because you can't explain it. If I could, it wouldn't be my true essence. Essence is inexplicable. It can't be explained. There's no way to define an essence. You feel, or you are aware of certain effects of it, but not the actual thing. There's no way to describe it. But that's what we're going to reach. But to get there, there's a process. And that's usually El. That's the month we're in now. The Medrash tells us that there's a, it's the when Moshe Rabbeinu went up the last time to receive the second Luchos, we know that God told Moshe Rabbeinu to come up to Mount Sinai, to come on Har Sinai, and he gave him the Luchos, and then when he came down, the Jews sinned, they did the golden calf, the Chet HaEgel, and Moshe broke the first Luchos, and then it took a whole another 40 days or whatever it was to beg and plead from God that he shouldn't wipe out the Jewish people, and he went back up from Rosh Hashanah, from Rosh Chodesh Elul is when he went back up. God told him, we'll give you a second set of luchos. And the Medrash says that day, Rosh Chodesh Elul, there was a shofar that was blown in the camp, in the Jewish encampment in the desert. They blew a shofar. Why? Because a shofar represents this idea of, be careful. Don't make the same mistake you made back then. In other words, when you're dealing with trying to elevate yourself and trying to, in this case, receive this godly inspiration, divine commandment, and so on and so forth, we got to make sure that we're ready for it and not screwing it up. So the shofar represents this idea of this awareness, this alarm, this sense of being aware of what the moment is, what we're dealing with, what's the situation. And then it's brought into halacha. Halacha describes that not only do we do it on the Rosh Chodesh Elul, but we do it throughout the whole month of Elul, because it represents this awakening from within. Blowing the shofar awakens a person to tshuva and makes a person become conscious of what the moment is. So, first of all, it's a very interesting thing that we use an animal horn for tshuva. Right? I was asking, you know, just on in more of a I wasn't really being more sarcastically. I asked the question. I said, nowadays that we have WhatsApp, so do you actually have to hear the shofar, like the real thing being blown, or it's enough to hear maybe you could press a WhatsApp and make the sounds, and that will be the same thing, right? The Mishnah in the Gemara says, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah says, that all shofaris, all anything that's called a shofar is kosher. You can use that. I don't know if the WhatsApp is called a shofar, but in other words, what the question really is, what's the shofar? What's this idea of the sound of the shofar, right? There's a lot spoken about the sound of the shofar. And this is supposed to awaken us. And if you think about the idea, it's very, very, it's a very dull sound. It's not musically, you know, developed. There's no rhythm to it necessarily. There's no harmonies coming along with it. It's a very pure, simple, non-complex sound. And that is the mitzvah. That is the requirement. The requirement is there to be one simple sound. And this one simple sound is supposed to wake us up and get us excited and say, now we want to connect back to God. So what is it about the shofar, and what is this idea of this recall, this calling, the call of the shofar that's supposed to wake us up? Another point, further down the road that we're holding now, meaning from Rosh Chodesh Elul, we speak about the blowing of the shofar, now moving further down. Last night, early this morning, we did the slichot, and it is a custom to do slichot in the Sephardi communities. They start already from Rosh Chodesh Elul, actually. In the Ashkenazi communities, they start from 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. So a year like this, where Rosh Hashanah falls out on Thursday, so you have a full 4 days of slichot from last night or early morning till Rosh Hashanah. So then we start, like we did this year, on the Motzei Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah. But let's say Rosh Hashanah will fall out on Monday or Tuesday, so then you would start the week before, and you'll have 7 days. But the reason is because you're supposed to have 4 days of preparation of slichot. Why? So one of the reasons given is because there, in the times when we used to bring korbanot, when we used to bring sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash, so at that time, there was a requirement that the animal had to be checked and inspected for any blemish 4 days before it was actually brought. Now you have to realize, every day, there was at least 2 korbanot brought. Before we daven, we say the korbanot, we say that we brought the korban tamid in the morning and the korban tamid in the afternoon. There was at least 2 korbanot brought. There always had to be in the Beit HaMikdash's farm, they had a little chamber, a farm, where they had all these animals. There had to be enough korbanot that will be able to be available within 4 days. In 4 days. Why? Because there's this 4-day period that's necessary for there to be the inspection of the animal to make sure it's pure. In fact, we find this also in the times when the Jews, the first Korban Pesach that the Jews did in Mitzrayim, the first time the Jews actually brought a korban was when they were in Mitzrayim. So God told Moshe, tell them to take the lamb and tie it next to their bed. When did he tell them to do it? 4 days before they were supposed to shecht it, before they slaughtered it, before they sacrificed it. Which again is this idea of, this 4 days correlates to this idea of checking and inspecting and you know, making sure there's no blemishes. So likewise, correspondingly, or it's an illusion, whatever words we want to say, it's the same process is happening when we start Slichot 4 days before Rosh Hashanah, because Rosh Hashanah is the time where we become a perfect sacrifice to God. We're an Ola. We're a Korban Ola. In fact, we mention in the Tefillot of Rosh Hashanah, one of the highlights of the Rosh Hashanah Tefillah is the Akedas Yitzchak, is when God told Avram Avinu to bring his son Isaac and put him on the Akedah and to at least what seemed to be, to slaughter him as a korban, as a sacrifice. And we remind God of that experience. That's part of the rememberings. We say 3 different types of tefillot on Rosh Hashanah. One of them is called the zichronot, to remember, to remind God, so to speak, of the experience of the Akedas Yitzchak. And it says that Yitzchak's ashes are constantly in front of God. He constantly, which is another question, if it's constantly in front of him, why does he have to be reminded about it? But I think you once gave a class on this, no? So the idea is that there's a certain, we're becoming this korban, we're becoming like Yitzchak. We're sacrificing ourselves, our true being, to God. And therefore we need 4 days before in order to properly clean ourselves and remove all blemishes. Now, there's obviously a fundamental difference between us and the animal. An animal that has a blemish, there's no way to take care of it. It's pasul. You can't use it anymore. The brilliance of us, Jews, is that there is no such a thing as a real permanent blemish. When we're inspecting ourselves, we're not inspecting ourselves to see, okay, am I fit to come to God on Rosh Hashanah? It's not like a question. The answer is, I'm going to be in front of God on Rosh Hashanah. The thing is, am I ready? Have I removed all those obstructions, all those challenges, all those insecurities of myself in order for me to present my true being in front of God? So what we see over here is that there's this experience of awakening ourselves, this experience of refining ourselves, of this rebirth, as we said, this idea of trying to become perfect or develop our inner self. That's this experience of the of Elul and Rosh Hashanah coming to the highlight of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But it's very interesting that we talk about this a lot. And probably every year you probably hear or you come across something that touches about this point of, you know, it's time to do tshuva, it's time to return to God, it's time to, you know, reconnect. And some of us get inspired, some of us hear a good talk about it, some of us, you know, go to shul and we daven a little bit more, we get excited. But at the end of the day, there's something deeper that tells we like ask ourselves, like, what are we really doing? How real is this? You know, are we really becoming this perfect Olah? Are we really sacrificing ourselves in front of God? Like, you know, it's a temporary state. It's a month maybe. For some it's a day. For some it's a minute. It's a very transient state with afterwards I'll probably be back to who I am. So what am I really doing now? And therefore a lot of times it's very easy to ignore the Elul message. We don't have a motivation to want to do something that we don't think is long-lasting. So on a very basic level, because there's always that, like, the anxiety, that am I really going to be successful? Am I really going to make it? Am I really going to transform myself? And am I really going to come into this year being a different person? And because we doubt ourselves, so all of a sudden there's like a certain, you know, we lose the impetus, we lose the drive, we become much more insecure of this process. So therefore, there's a certain like wanting to tune out. You know, don't exert myself if I don't really think I'm going to be successful anyway, type of thing. But then there's also a much deeper experience, which I think takes place over here. There's a much deeper experience on the time of Elul, which we're not just asking whether we'll be successful or not, or whether we'll actually proper fully change. We're really asking the question of, what does it mean I need to change? What am I changing into? What am I becoming? What am I supposed to be different than I was before? There's like a certain unknown, a certain ambiguity, there's a certain uncertainty of where I'm supposed to be, and therefore when I'm saying work, change, tshuva, what does that all mean? So I'm not going to discuss exactly what the tshuva process is that I'm sure you've heard a lot about, or I'm sure there's been discussion about that. I just want to mainly touch upon the point of why are we so reluctant to really work on ourselves. The pasuk says that man was created to work. It's an interesting idea. Right? That a person was created to work. And the Gemara has a whole question, what does that mean? Does it mean physical labor? Does it mean a person has to go out to the field? Does a person have to go to business? Is that what it means, that a person was made to work? And what profession? What do we mean by work? Work over here, the literal translation of amal means toil. It means to go deep, to dig, to find. Amal has a very strong correlation with the idea of inui, a certain deep refinement of oneself. When we're brought into this world, we're not perfect. We're not perfect at all. We're undeveloped. Just take a look at a child. A child may have hands, may have feet, may have eyes, may have a nose. They have the physical functions. They even have a brain. But no one's going to say that the child is developed. It takes sometimes 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years to say that the child now has developed. I don't know if we ever fully develop, but that's a different story. But man, the way man was created, which is different than an animal, the way man is created is that man has to work. He has to become something. He has to develop himself. He has to actualize his potential, whatever words we want to use. The core of our being is everything that we are is in us, but it's not developed. It's not brought out. So a person was born to work, to toil. That's our job. And we become very, very much, you know, aware of it as soon as life becomes difficult. As soon as life becomes difficult, all of a sudden we realize, hey, we hit a wall. You know, your first teenage years, it's before teenage years, you know, you go from 1, 2, 3, when you reach 10 years old, 11, life is like a dream, it's like a movie, it just flies by, you don't really appreciate, you don't press pause, nothing is really bothering you too profoundly about life, you know, it moves, it goes, you know, it doesn't bother us so much. Once we start reaching 13, 14, 15, we don't know why, but all of a sudden we start freaking out. Things are not working, right? The teenage years are always a massive struggle in us. You know, I once heard a good analogy for this. It's like if we would put a teenager to be a conductor in front of a symphony, the music would be chaotic. Right? Because there's no self-identity. It's complete chaos. And that's when we start really questioning ourselves. There's an identity crisis that goes on in that stage. Who are we? What do we want in life? Why are we here? What are we going to make ourselves? How are we going to make? Like, all these questions of the almo kick in, but we have no basis almost. We have no grounding. We have nothing to fall back on for us to say we're this, and therefore we're going to work on being this. It's all a confusion. And it's coupled with the fact that you try, a lot of teenagers run away from what they were brought up from, because there's almost like a subconscious resentment to, till now you were dependent on your parents, now you want to be independent. And there's a thought in there that to be independent means you have to run away from your past. Because as long as I'm following the path that my parents set out for me, it means I'm still dependent on them. And that's part of the identity struggle that teenagers go through. Eventually, you reach 20, 21, 22, and depending how the teenage years molded you, then you're going to have a different type of 20s and 30s. This crucial teenage, I've had a lot of experience. I mean, I had my own experience. I was a teenager, but I had a lot of experience, you know, dealing and speaking with guys at this age and even older. And you could almost predict, even though that's not proper. You can never predict, and you should never predict, but you could see certain tendencies depending on how the child is going through this teenage years. There's a tremendous confusion. 20s, 30s, that's all of a sudden where the person has already begun to adapt some sort of identity for themselves, and that's how they begin to live their life. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good, sometimes they're happy, sometimes they're not so happy, but there's at least a certain stability in their life. They ever found a point where they could say, this is me. You know, teenagers get very excited about things. They want to become, you know, famous. Every teenager wants to become famous. Why? Because there's no identity, right? So you need others to make you an identity. So you become famous, others will give you an identity. When you get older, you realize fame is not only it's not me, but it's a waste of time. It's a pain. It's not something which I'll really is allowing me to really be myself. But there's other forms of getting other people to give us an identity. We don't necessarily adapt our true identity. So this is the Adam, this is man, the way man develops. We start off as a kid, as an infant, not knowing really much what's going on. We're taking it in the world. We develop slowly, 4, 5, 6, Our minds are full with all these new ideas and sensations. We have really no clue what's going on. Comes the 12, 13, 14, and all of a sudden there's this massive crash, and then we're trying to trying to work out through it, trying to now create an identity of who we are. This process is very similar to when the Yidden were in the desert. When the Yidden were in the desert, they were born, Yitzias Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, the Exodus was their birth. And in their state of birth, there was a lot of confusion. There was no identity of who they were. And for the first 40 years, they had no clue of who they were. In fact, they were a child. They didn't understand God. You know, we ask always the question, how is it possible for the Jews in the desert they saw such great miracles. God split the sea for them. God provided them food in the desert, this man and all, and how could they just rebel? You constantly hear them rebelling and fighting against God. Well, you think about it. When you're a little child, you tell them to go to sleep and they don't listen. They give you a fit, right? They throw a fit. Or when you want them to go to school and then, what do you mean? I took care of you for the past 3 years when you couldn't do a thing, right? The child doesn't think that way. A child thinks he deserves it. The child thinks that this is natural. This is what he deserves. And then eventually, once the child maybe reaches about 35 years old or has their own children, do they realize, this what unbelievable what my parents were doing for me. So the Jews went through a similar experience. But what does it mean for us? So what am I trying to bring out in this point? Is that our very nature, our very beginning of our lives is a one constant, perpetual working on ourselves. Whether we realize it or not, whether we appreciate it or not, whether we're conscious of it or not, the bottom line is every single stage of our life, there's a constant progress being made, whether it's a good, progressive, positive progression, or God forbid, the other way around. You know, there's theories out there in personalities that there's no person who has a real set personality because we're constantly evolving, we're constantly changing. We're never really the same person we were 5 minutes ago. I like putting it this way, that life is time. Time is automatic change. And if time is automatic change, the moment was before, the moment that's now is never the same that it was before. So therefore, automatically, as us human beings, we're constantly evolving just in a matter of time. But the point is that there's constant movement, there's constant change, there's constant development. How conscious are we of it? So when a big event takes place, you have a child, all of a sudden, wow. Then you become aware of what it means that you've developed, you've grown. It really hits you strongly. But otherwise, it's like, okay, fine, as they say in Jewish, anechta kintag, what else is new? There's no appreciation of that growth or that change or whatever it is. We don't pause. We don't really focus on it. And part of the reason why we don't focus on it is because we don't really think much is happening. We don't, it's like a person who's working out, let's say you're on a diet. You want to look a certain way. You want to lose weight or you want to, build up, This is another thing of the male teenager. They have to build up. Part of building their identity is to look a certain way, have a certain physical physique, especially in today's modern world. Thank God we give the right perspective of how you're supposed to look, that if you have any, physical defects in your body, there's something wrong with you. So therefore, you go to the gym and you work. Now, if you're going to look in the mirror every single day to see if, you're where you want to be, you'll never see growth, right? But there's a constant want because you think you have a goal, you have something you want to work for, you have something you want to reach, there's something you want to go, you want to achieve. So the goal itself is constantly motivating you to see the change, to see you're working, you're consciously working on something. But most of us don't necessarily have that vision. We don't necessarily see ourselves as trying to develop into something, necessarily. Okay, we want to get a job, so we know maybe we have to go to school, and we have to get a degree, and we want to, have children, so we have to get married, and we have certain goals, so to speak, but as a constant day in, day out, minute to minute basis of constant growth, we don't see that. We don't live our lives that way. But that's Adam L'Omol Yulad. A man is created that way. We are constantly, moment to moment, minute to minute, changing. In fact, it's to the point that the Gemara tells us in Rosh Hashanah that the Gemara has a discussion whether or not we are judged only once a year or we're judged every day And according to some opinions, every moment we're judged. How could you? Every moment. What happened to yesterday and today? What's the difference? Because we're changed. We're a different person. The moment we were before is not the same person we are now. Literally in this very room. It's not just because I'm talking and I'm saying constantly different things. Maybe, I hope so. But it's the very fact that time itself makes us change. And that's why you have to do the same prayers you did yesterday. You daven shachrit, you daven mincha, you daven marv. You have to do it again today. What do you mean? I did it yesterday. Did the same thing. I said the same words. For a man, he put on tefillin yesterday. Yeah. Of course, that is the change in itself. Success doesn't mean how I want to be. Yeah. Right. Well, you've gained the experience of the day in and day out struggle. Of course there's a change. Absolutely. You're touching on a point which I want to get to maybe in a moment. The Alter Rebbe and Tanya deals with this issue. But it's a very crucial to this. So the every moment we're changed. That's why we have to constantly do mitzvot, the same mitzvot we did yesterday, we got to do today, because every single second we're constantly doing something different. We're constantly a different person. There's a new me. Even biologically speaking, right? The blood, for example, constantly replenishes. Our atoms in our body constantly replenish. We're not the same person physically even than we were before, right? We're not the same person. Okay, the DNA in the body, you know, regulates certain ways. But there's a nature to it. But we're not the same person physically, psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually. We're not the same person anymore. But we don't sense it. It's not conscious by us. And because of that, we don't really appreciate, A, what we did achieve or what the change really is, and we don't either appreciate what it means to really work and actively or consciously make change and make growth. Because we're so used to a certain natural progression of life where I go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. My birthday was yesterday, so okay, I reached a new age. Okay, what does that mean? You know, what did I just, you know? Nature makes things happen naturally, right? So there's a natural flow. You don't begin to process where you've come from to where you're going. It's so subconscious. So then all of a sudden we have the shofar. What is the shofar doing? What is the shofar saying? The simple note, the simple non-very musical note that's supposed to awaken. Why does it awaken within us? Because it brings us back to our state of a child. Our state of a child, that infant state, where all this complexity of life, all the way that we've, you know, the intellect that we've gathered, the mind that we developed, our emotional state, our psychological state, all these things, these great complexities that we've developed over the past 5, 6, 7, 20, 50, however old we are, over life, and therefore life just becomes this natural progression without a moment to think of who we are and what we really are, all of a sudden the sound of the shofar, that simple sound, just triggers back into that infant state. You know, today in you could one of the forms of therapy is to try to trigger back into the brain, to reach back into a state of infancy where there was that pure, unmolded form of the person, where you could tap back into that source, you could redevelop, you could rechange, or you could, you know, get over certain traumas, whatever it may be. So the sound of the shofar, the simple sound of the shofar, what is it doing when we listen to it? It's like a cry of a child, quite literally. What's a cry of a child? A cry of a child is simple. It's no complexity there. It's just a state of being, a true state of being without the complexities, without the natural courses of nature taking its roots and its establishments of who our identity is. It's to a pre-existing identity state, a pre-identity state. That's what the sound of the shofar is really doing to us, if we're tuned into it. But sometimes even that doesn't really wake us up. You know, the title of this Will You Hit the Snooze? And you think about it, you wake up in the morning, you got to go to work, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, you're exhausted, even if you don't have an infant child. No one likes waking up in the morning. It's another very interesting phenomenon about human nature. We don't like waking up in the morning, right? So it's 7 o'clock, and you know you could go to work, you could be a little late, so you hit the snooze. All right, I'll do it late, and I'll get up in 5 minutes. And you keep on doing it. By the time you're like, oh, I got to run now, you know, like now I got to hop around. The last 5 minutes, you jump out of bed, you're half naked, running into the bathroom, trying to brush your teeth. And by the time you finish, you ran, oh, I forgot my car keys, I run back in. It's chaos. And what? And who am I? I'm all miserable. I'm so tense up because I just had to rush out. And now, how's my day going to be? Imagine such a day at work. You come, good morning. All right, I'm sure you had a good morning. You know, like, well, what's the feeling? It's not so exciting. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, your little child is crying, and the whole world has changed for them. You know, till now they were in this cozy little place. All of a sudden they come out, and now there's no security. They have no sense of security for themselves, right? And they're crying. If you're tense, you're not allowing them to calm down. You have to be calm for them to be calm. And if they're not calm, they won't eat properly. They'll just scream. But that's what we do to ourselves day in and day out. We hit the snooze, we'll work on it later, and therefore when we feel the moment of absolute, we hit the wall, then we try all of a sudden to make it all happen in 5 minutes. Right? Life happens to us, we don't think about it, all of a sudden we hit a midlife crisis, it becomes, we get depressed, or we get anxious. What do we do now? I gotta run to my therapist, I gotta take my anti-anxiety pill. Why? Because I've reached the point of this crushing moment of where I just have, you know, I can't hit the snooze anymore because I'm suffering. But the hitting of the snooze is this like default setting we have, you know, like, all right, I don't feel the pressure. I don't see it happening. It's not real to me. It's a process that's not real. You don't really see how these moments are crucial. But you hear about these great people that they wouldn't waste a moment. You know, that every moment that they had, they were constantly busy. And you think to yourself, how much time do we waste in our lives? You think about it. God gave us 70, 80 years, 120 years. Life, we should have all Chayim Nitzchiyim, eternal life. And you think about it. People say, I don't want to live to 120. I'll be miserable. What am I going to do all that time? Right? And then the Mishnah tells us, it's better one moment of doing a good action, of doing tshuva in this world and everything that's going to happen in the world to come. And like, really? One moment? I have another 50 years to live. We don't appreciate what it means to change. We don't appreciate what it means to grow literally moment to moment, minute to minute. We come Rosh Hashanah, it's like, oh, wow, what happened the past year? You know, there's when we daven Rosh Hashanah on Yom Kippur, so in the Shachar Tefillah, we start off, so there's, during the rest of the year, let's say in Shabbat, so we usually start from right before Yishtabach. So there's Shochan Admor Mekodesh Shemo, but on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we start from HaMelech, right? Especially Rosh Hashanah represents the time when we're anointing God as king, the coronation of God. We're empowering, so to speak, God to become our king. And there's the custom is to say HaMelech loud, right? So the Chazan will get up there, and there's a whole build-up, a little bit of a song, a little bit of melody, and then it goes HaMelech, right? So what's this whole HaMelech all about? So it's And the later also there's this little passage that we have a similar point where there's a certain outburst of God's greatness. So there's a story about one of the great Hasidic rebbes of Rabbi Aaron Karlina. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Ko Echsoif song, right? A very popular Shabbat song, Ko Echsoif. Very popular, famous in Israel. I think they play it sometimes on Friday afternoon instead of some other, right before Shabbat. That's the siren, they play Ko Echsoif. At any rate, he's a composer of this, a very holy man. So he once was living this experience on Rosh Hashanah, and all of a sudden, out of this great intensity, he jumps up and yells out this feeling of greatness of God, the Hamelech, the Shema Godol, and this great feeling. And they asked him afterwards, what was this great inspiration? So he says he reminded himself of a Gemara. The Gemara relates the story that during the Second Temple, at the end when the Romans were surrounded the city of Jerusalem, the siege of Jerusalem. So there was a lot of inner conflict in Jerusalem at the time. There was many factions over there. There was a lot of inner fighting, and the sage at the time, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, wanted to make peace with the Romans. He knew from divine, inspiration and from the messages of the prophets that we weren't gonna win this war. We were doomed to go into Galut. So he wanted to sue peace. So he went out. There was a whole story how he got out. He comes out of the walls of Jerusalem and he meets the Roman general, which is Vespasian, right? And he greets Vespasian and he says, "Emperor." He calls him the emperor. So Vespasian tells him, he says, "I have to kill you. You're deserving of death. You deserve to die." So he says, "Why?" He says, "Because first of all, I'm not the emperor. The emperor is in Rome. Calling me the emperor is a sign of that's number one. And if I really am the emperor, what took you so long to come here? Now you come to me. If I'm the king and you're waiting so long to come to me." So Rabbi Aaron Karlina was feeling that. The whole year, we don't think of God. We're not conscious of this process. All of a sudden, it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we get excited. And now we want to be connected. It's that push, that last moment. We snooze till the last moment. And we try to chaperine, as we say. We try to grab everything in that last moment, the Rosh Hashanah experience. Here, and then we're supposed to live it off the rest of the year. We're supposed to somehow change. We're supposed to try to grow. But we go back to default setting right afterwards. We're back to stage one. We're not feeling it anymore. We're not experiencing it anymore. So the very fact, the very nature of our being, like I said, is this being in this default setting is not wanting to change, not wanting to grow. Not being conscious of the change and the growth that we're doing. And then the sound of the shofar is triggering this awakening. Let's go. Let's return back to our natural state. Let's actualize who we really are. Let's become the true me. For the past 30 years, or the past 30 days, or the past 30 seconds, I was someone else. I wasn't living my true self. Now let me try to really become in tune with who I really am. Tshuva, the translation in English of tshuva is repentance. That's not the true meaning of tshuva. Tshuva is not repentance. Tshuva means to return. Return to who? To who I really am. That's what tshuva is. Tshuva means returning back to my state. It says, toshuv enosh adaka. That there's a certain crushing, there's a certain essence of the person that has to be brought out through a crushing that is going to be the true me. The sound of the shofar is trying to get us back to that state. It's trying to wake us up and try to say, remember who you really are. Try to get in tune with that. The infants, and it's deeper than just getting in tune with who you really are, because in that state you actually do change. When you see this potential of who you really are, you see an infant, and as a father now, thank God, Baruch Hashem, you have great visions for your child. That's dangerous also. You have to let the child grow for himself, but you want to try to really educate the child on give them the best education. You want them to mature and develop for and reach their full capacities and development. You think the child sees it? I don't remember seeing it, Right? I didn't go through this conscious process. Someone else, my parents, saw it in me. God sees it in us. But we're sloughing. The alarm goes, okay, snooze, next 5 minutes. But there's a constant, every moment to moment, there's a constant new me being given. There's a constant new me being developed. There's a constant new me being changed. And am I conscious of this change? Do I want to be conscious? Do I want to grow? Do I really appreciate the growth? Do I realize what the moment is all about? Not necessarily. But what does it really mean to change then? So when we're talking about this change, if we're not going to hit the snooze, we're going to say, you know what? Now let me be something. Let me actually take the bull by the horns and let me make myself who I really should be. Living in today's generation is a very hard thing for two reasons. First of all, the world presents itself. Today's the Western culture has already infiltrated our minds from a very young age to create this identity of who we should be. The Hollywood dream, right? The Hollywood movie has given us the sense of what's life, right? The glory, the fame, the money, the looks. All that's life. That's making it a life. And because of the Hollywood dream, the American dream, whatever words we want to use, so we're already working, we're fighting, we're already at a disadvantage over here. From day one, you know, today's day and age, you know, we're talking about child education and things like that. Today's day and age, the teacher, the parent, is up against the iPhone. Right? A child, once he's already 6 years old, I mean, two, 6 years old, when they're 2 years old, they know how to use a thing better than you do. And that's the way they live their life. Right? And to a certain extent, we like it, because they're crying, and we don't have the patience to take care of them. Okay, let's use the iPhone, let's use the iPad. But once they're in tune with that, forget it. What type of education, what are we giving them? What do they have after that? So we're up against the iPhone. Today in a student in class, he has to sit in front of a book that's black and white for more than 15 seconds. This ain't going to work. Because the screen is colorful and it switches every 5 seconds. And if you don't like it, we don't read anything, by the way, today. You know, it's like, I checked it up online. You went like this. That's what you did. You know, you saw 5 words. I'm already an expert at it. Why? Because the computer says it, right? We think we know so much. And I say today's day and age, we're a generation of information and of no knowledge. Because everything is on the computer. Everything is on, you know, everything is on Wikipedia. But so we know nothing. But it's there, you know. Yeah, sure. So our education system, whatever, that's not the point. The point is that we're up against the iPhone. We're already at a disadvantage trying to get in tune with our real self, or we're battling uphill. So that's one major disadvantage that we have on this in trying to change. But then there's a much deeper personal problem with hardship in this change. And that is that there's a certain natural hesitation to want to change. It's work. It's a lot of work. And we don't like working. In today's society, we do not know what work means. You know, I have this another thing that I like saying. You know, today's day and age, if a person is struggling with an issue, so there's two paths. Either we take a pill to get rid of the problem, or we write a book explaining why it's okay and we don't have to deal with it anymore. When everybody could agree with me that it's okay, so I don't got the problem. So we never want to work. It's always the quick fix. You go to your therapist, how do I overcome my, you know, so, okay, you'll have to come tomorrow, you have to come next time, you're coming. Finally, that you realize that he wants to make the money, so he just keep on bringing you back every single time. But for me, what am I doing? I'm still miserable, I'm still depressed. So fine, okay, we'll give you an antidepressant. Ah, yeshikoyach, now I fixed the problem. Right, and if you don't want to spend the money on the therapist, so then you have to find other means to rationalize why it's okay. We're very good at that. We don't. The words in the Hebrew words is that Adam Karav Eitzel Atzmei, a person is subjective to himself. We do not see our own faults. Avas Atzmei, self-love is what holds us back from ever really wanting to change. We don't like looking in the mirror. Why don't we like looking in the mirror? Because looking in the mirror forces us to want to change. But there's a hesitation. The default setting is easy. It doesn't take a lot of work or energy. So when we're fighting against these two things, it leaves life very difficult. Number one, we're working uphill against the iPhone. modern technology, thank God. And number two, more importantly, there's that wanting to stay on the default setting. It's easier not to. From a personal experience, I was in an accident a number of years ago, so at the time then I had to relearn how to walk. That itself was a whole thing. But now, I still never really learned properly. I have to do therapy now. It's demoralizing. You know, like he tells you, okay, so I'll live through the pain. Fine, yes, go, yeah. To do these exercises and to really like be conscious every moment. I have to be conscious every single time I'm walking now to make sure I'm walking properly, that I build up the muscles necessary in order for me to walk. The default setting was easier. The child getting up to walk, it's better when a child, you know, if we would have to learn how to walk when we're 15 years old, forget about it. We'll all be on four legs still now. We'll still be crawling. That's the reality. Because the default setting, the brain is the biggest, gets in the way so much. We start thinking and overthinking and analyzing and trying to make sense of it and how are we going to do it? Are we going to be successful? And because of all these thoughts, we end up going nowhere. You know, I had students that would come to me and they say, you know, the learning is not for me. I can't learn. I said, have you ever tried? He says, of course, I've been sitting here, you know, for the past, and before I came to you, I was sitting in school for the past. I said, yeah, but were you learning? He says, yeah, of course. What do you mean I learned? I said, how much of your brain was focused on the learning, and how much of the brain was thinking about whether you'll remember an information, whether you're able to pass the test, whether or not you actually know and understand what you're learning? 70-80% of your brain was busy focused on everything else but the learning. The brain comes in and starts making you crazy with all the questions and doubts and so on and so forth. So for me, learning how to walk now, the default setting is very easy. I mean, it's not easy. It's painful, but it's easy in the sense, okay, you know, all right, I'll live with it. I've gone through the worst of it, so to speak, in my head. You know, not being able to walk, okay, that I can't deal with. You know, every person wants to be able to walk. Okay, how well am I walking? Could I run? Could I jog? Okay. But that's the way we are. That's the default setting. The brain kicks in and says, so work, literally, amal means to work. Work means to toil, it means to really, to develop, doesn't just, there's a natural process of this. Change is happening, but how much in control am I of that change? And how much am I making it happen? Am I conscious of it? As you're walking, as you're thinking, as you're, you know, talking, all the processes that we do on a day-to-day basis, am I conscious of whether or not these particular actions are actually going to reach my true essence, going to bring out my true being? Or am I constantly pressing the snooze and saying, you know, I'll work on it later? I can't be bothered now. That's the message of the Shofar. The Shofar is coming to say, wake up. What does it mean, wake up? Realize that every single moment of the day, every single action I do is actually changing me. Consciously, not so much, but subconsciously, definitely. Am I really in tune with it? Am I really in control of it? Am I just allowing myself to be programmed without me being in control of that program? And if I'm allowing myself to be in control of that program, am I really choosing the right program for myself? Or am I using the program that has been put out there on the streets? The one that the iPhone says. And then 5 years from now, when I've already been so, you know, embedded and nurtured through this type of environment, now I realize life is miserable, so now I want to change. So I snooze for the past 5 years, and now I want to change, and now what am I do? So I have to take a pill, or have to rationalize why it's okay. That's the Shofar call. Literally, the Shofar call is that pure, that simple, that child, that undeveloped self, that pure self. No default setting, because it hasn't been created yet, a default setting. And the brilliant thing of that what we have is, as we said before, the 4 days before Rosh Hashanah is when we have the opportunity to actually delete, reboot, reprogram ourselves. Believe it. Because if you don't believe it, it doesn't work. You know, people say, you know, people are very into science. And then, you know, the whole placebo effect and all that. So they're like, yeah, it doesn't really work. You know, it's not real. You gave him a sugar pill. Did it help? Did this person recover? Who cares what it was? So you think it has to be because there's some sort of chemical that changed the person's brain. He did it himself through thinking that it's going to work. If you don't believe in it, it doesn't work. If you don't think you're going to change, if you don't think that you could change, if you don't think you could reprogram yourself, you're not going to be able to change. You're not going to be able to reprogram yourself. You know, there's a very interesting halacha. The halacha says that if you would bring a korban, a sacrifice to the temple because you did something that you weren't supposed to, so you have to bring an atonement. If you don't believe that this works, it won't work. You can't come to a day of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and say, God, please forgive me. And deep down, you're really saying, nah, he's not, there's a God out there. He really believes this. I believe it. That doesn't work. Because in order for the system, our system, especially the Jewish system, in order for there to be any growth, any development, we first have to believe in absolute truth that this is. That I am someone that could change, that God gave me the ability to reprogram myself. But then there's a tremendous amount of work. It's a tremendous amount. Don't let anybody fool you. Don't let anybody tell you that it's easy. You know, we love hearing that answer today. You go to the psychologist will tell you, don't worry about it. You know, take two aspirin, go to sleep, and you'll be fine. You know, there's this wanting to make it easy and get over it. That's not what's going to happen. Life is difficult. Life is work. Life is change, moment to moment, minute to minute, day by day, year by year. And we're constantly being programmed whether we like it or not. Are you in control of it or not? Are you hitting snooze, or are you actually actively trying to make and reach the true program of who you really are? That's the question over here. We create for ourselves these goals. We try to imagine that we have to be a certain way, and we want to overcome a struggle. Let's say we're struggling, let's say, with some depression or some anxiety. So we want to overcome the depression and anxiety. And instead of looking at the day-to-day, minute-to-minute relationship that I'm trying to have with myself, I'm busy focusing on trying to overcome the depression or the specific thing that's bothering me. What about the deeper self? It's not about just the specific details. About, okay, I have this issue that's bothering me. The issue will be resolved once I take back and I'm in control of me developing myself. Doesn't mean the issue will go by necessarily entirely, but I'm in control of the issue more than I ever was before. You know, one of the things I say, a person who's struggling with OCD, if you identify yourself as that you have obsessive compulsive disorder, then you've already shot yourself in the foot. If you identify yourself as a person, first and foremost, normal, that has this particular thing that they get obsessive compulsive, so then you already have a handle on it. There's something you could deal with. You're in control of it. It's not in control over you. So the call of the shofar, this wakening of the shofar, this alarm clock, this sound is coming to tell me you get back in control of your life. And hitting the snooze is just going to make you rush the last minute when you feel completely trapped, when you can feel completely out of control, and then, like we said before, you're in a state of chaos. You're in a state of complete disorder. There's no sense of peace. There's no sense of really growing. There's no real sense of inner satisfaction. Like I said before, waking up in the morning and rushing to work, you come in, you're miserable. But change is another. Let's finish off with this last point. Change does not necessarily mean that I see this tremendous change in myself. We can't make that mistake, and I think this goes back to your point. We're not looking, you know, the Tanya, the Bala Tanya says, and it's quoted in other places as well by other, you know, Talmidei of the Baal Shem Tov, that if a person expects themselves to get over a challenge, if that's their objective, then they're making a big mistake. Because God created people, and the words the Alter Rebbe Bala Tanya says is, Ulai lakach Nivra, maybe this is why and how he was created, that these should be this constant struggle. If you're struggling with wanting to overcome your temptations, your struggle, your desire, that's not a problem. Every moment of the struggle is another deeper programming of yourself. You're just being, troubleshooting a particular issue and constantly coming with ways to deal with it. The experience itself is so it's subtle, the change. And that subtle change is what's so deep, because just think about it the other way. The very fact that we just go on this default setting and the moment to moment we're having these subtle changes in our mind, we turn around, we're 50 years old, like, how did I turn out to be this person? Because every second there was the subtle change, the subconscious change. But if we know and we realize that we have the same ability to have those subtle changes, but we're in control of those subtle changes, and we can make those subtle changes develop the true
person of who we really are. Then we'll turn back in 50 years and say, wow, you know, this is I'm happy, I'm satisfied, I'm doing what I want. And when it comes to what we're talking about now, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and we'll end with this, when we're coming to Rosh Hashanah, we want God to give us a good year. But deeper yet, we're coming to God, we're saying, God, I want to be in your presence on a day-to-day basis. I really want to be in your embrace. I'm coming now as a simple child, as an ola, as a complete sacrifice, just wanting to be embraced and being showered with your God, with your kindness and your greatness and your kingship. And I'm coming with a simple servant's perspective. I'm now ready to be programmed with your program. And I'm willing to take the control that I need. I'm willing to be aware of every moment, of every day, of every hour, of every second, of how this program is supposed to affect my life. Even when I'm showering, even when I'm eating, even when I'm sleeping, the godly program is being affected on me. That's what's happening now in Rosh Hashanah. That's what's going to be on Yom Kippur. That's what's happening, though. Now I'm awakening myself to realize that's what I really want. The Kabbalah's oil, the accepting of God's kingship, the acceptance of God's program, and saying, this is how I want to be programmed. And again, don't think the program is easy. It's a very, you know, it's, you know, like in, what is in the Navy SEALs, what do they have, Hell Week, right? So, you know, it's something like that, but this is a lifelong process, you know. No breaks. No breaks. It's hard. And you always hear the expression, oy vi shveretz es ein ayid. You know, we're very into the oy vavoys. You know, whenever you see a non-Jew, like someone who says, oy, that's the way they identify us as oy. Unfortunately, we've gone through thousands of years of persecution. That's where the oy comes from. But the oy is because it's not easy. It's not easy. And it's not even necessarily satisfactory. The satisfaction is not necessarily conscious. But it's me. When you're up with your child at 6 o'clock in the morning and the child hasn't slept and you haven't slept, it's not easy. But there's no greater sense of self than at that moment where you could see your child and you're hoping the child will fall asleep, not because you want to go to sleep, because you want your child to sleep. And when the child finally falls asleep, you just feel, wow. Is it easy? It's not easy. Is it satisfaction? What satisfaction do you have? The child's going to cry in 20 minutes again also. But there's no greater feeling of self than at those moments. So anyways, L'chaim, we're coming out to this time, we should be able to experience this true self. Really reach in deep. Really want it. Don't hit the snooze. Be in control. And not just be in control, but be in control of every moment, of every second. And don't think it's going to be easy. Allow ourselves to be tuned into God's program. The program that's going to bring us our true self. Allow ourselves to live our lives on our true way. And only through that do we then come to a Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and we actually feel like we're standing lefnei Hashem, that we're standing in front of God. That's where we're the Ola Tamima. That's where we're the complete sacrifice. We're completely a complete sacrifice to God in the sense that there's no inner doubts or questions or not being in control. We're in one whole complete package in front of God and say, you develop us. And there's no greater teacher, there's no greater parent, there's no greater king than Hashem. So we should merit to be able to experience this Rosh Hashanah. But obviously the ultimate is we want that we're going to really experience this when Mashiach comes through our work, through our process, through our struggle, through our determination. We're going to make this happen. We're going to be programmed with the program of the kingship of God, which is going to rule forever and ever, should be immediately taken from Yad Mamash.